Blog Talk Radio. where we're letting freedom ring here on Blog Talk Radio. Thank you, Elton John. Never get enough of that song. I'm your host, Daria DiGiovanni, and I want to thank you for joining me this evening. I'm very excited to bring on tonight as my guest my good friend and co-host on Conservative Republican Forum here on Blog Talk Radio on Saturdays at 6 p.m., and candidate for Florida State House in District 89, Stephen Rosenblum. But before I go ahead and bring on Steve so we can have, so we can talk about the issues and find out where he stands on things and how things are going with his campaign, I just wanted to make a few comments on the big news of the week, which were the primaries on Tuesday night, and in particular, the Delaware Senate race. Much has been happening this week in regards to that, and I'm so thrilled that Christine O'Donnell pulled an upset victory over Mike Castle in the small wonder state. And I've written about it extensively on parkbench.com. I put a link up in the chat room. That's parkbench with a C.com. And, this is such an interesting race because it's sort of kind of flying under the radar. And until, of course, Sarah Palin got involved and Jim DeMint, and a lot of prominent bloggers like Tammy Bruce, and bloggers and talk radio hosts, Tammy Bruce, Dan Reel, and others. And it just blows my mind, I guess, the reaction now that we're having from the old guard, the old GOP elite. And I'm speaking specifically of Karl Rove and Dr. Charles Krauthammer. Now, Dr. Charles I have a tremendous amount of respect for. Karl Rove, I have to say, I've never really liked him. I know he was a big shill for amnesty during the Bush administration. I just never felt that he was a solid, principled conservative. I always kind of got the feeling from him that he was more about politics as a business. And I just always got sort of like a cold feeling from him. I don't really know how to explain it. But both of them have just demonstrated utter contempt for this woman. And along with many bloggers on the right and certainly those on the left. And I just wanted to point out a couple of quick things. First of all, for anyone to suggest that Mike Castle is any kind of moderate is just completely ridiculous. The man is a George Soros Republican. Michelle Malkin has posted extensively about him on her blog. Among other things, he voted for cap and trade. He only signed on to oppose Obamacare as late as July 30th of this year. And it was only after his opponent, Christine O'Donnell, was pressuring him about it, because it certainly wasn't a principled position. I mean, we here in Florida, our attorney general filed a lawsuit the next day back in March. And certainly there was pressure from the grassroots all around the country on Congress to do something, especially at the GOP, to state their vocal opposition to that. So voted for cap and trade, very weak on repealing Obamacare. He voted for TARP. He's a big spending Republican, also voted for the Disclose Act. So this man was almost as left as Coons, the Democratic opponent that Christine O'Donnell is now facing. So I was just happy to see a 30-year incumbent career politician who went from, well, I don't know what he was making 30 years ago, but he certainly wasn't a millionaire 30 years ago when he was elected to Senate. And he spent 30 years and in the course of that time has become a millionaire at the public dole. And I think it's high time. I thought it was high time for Mike Castle to step aside now, as it is for many of these incumbents. And I think Christine O'Donnell is a great candidate. She's not perfect. None of us are. But I think, as is the case with Karl Rove, making her financial troubles into an issue and the fact that it took her a long time to pay back her student loans is only endearing her to normal everyday Americans who can relate to having financial problems, who can relate to having to pay back student loans. And, as far as the IRS, a lot of people can relate to being harassed by the IRS as well. And she has responded, and she's posted documentation on her website from the IRS saying whatever lien they put against her was done in error. It was a clerical error on their part. And, regardless of all of that, for Karl Rove not to at least be a gentleman the other night on Sean Hannity's show and say, I didn't support her. I supported Mike Castle. I feel maybe there are some, I feel there are some problems with her candidacy, but I wish her the best or something. But instead he just went on this just total trash takedown of her. I mean, I was watching it live, and I could hardly believe my eyes and my ears. I mean, he was like a petulant child almost that just was just so offended that the voters of Delaware said, you know what, we've had enough of Mike Castle. And it was also a slap in the face to the voters. So I'm just thrilled that she won and was very excited to see the grassroots reply to Karl Rove, not just on blogs and not just vocally, but with their pocketbooks. I mean, this woman, her campaign has raised $1 million in less than 24 hours. So the beauty of the internet and the grassroots activists all across the country who said, you know what, don't worry, NRSC, you don't have to fund Christine O'Donnell, we'll take care of it. And it just, I don't know, I'm just continually amazed by the power and resolve of the American people, and I'm just very proud of it. And just on a final note, I mean, those who are obsessing over comments that this woman has made about sex, I mean, since when has it been illegal to have an opinion about something? I care about where she stands on the issues, and she's made that very clear, that she will vote to repeal Obamacare. She's for limited government. She's for strong national defense. And unlike Rosie O'Donnell, Christine O'Donnell recognizes that global jihad is a real threat to all of us, and she's not a truther like Rosie O'Donnell. So I just had to throw that in there because I saw somebody mention that on Twitter. So I'm just really thrilled with the election results on Tuesday. I think the Tea Party is has had a successful year, and I think that we've successfully put the GOP establishment on notice, and we're done with politics as usual. I mean, we've got Obama and the Democrats driving this country over a cliff. And there are people who are worried about statements Christine O'Donnell made on MTV back in 1996 about sex. It's crazy. Anyway, I'm just really looking forward to November. Very excited. Can't wait to vote for Marco Rubio and Alan West, among others. And I just saw on the polls today, Marco Rubio is going strong. He's got a 16-point lead over Charlie Crist. The state has now been put into the Florida Senate race has now been put into the Leans Republican column. And, we got to keep working hard, and not get complacent. And I, among other things, I signed up to be a poll watcher last night to help do my part. But it's the grassroots in this country that's really going to take it back. So without further ado, let me go ahead and bring Steve on because I feel like I'm rambling, but I'm just so excited about these election results. One other one that of note that I want to mention, too, is I want to congratulate Sean Bylot in Massachusetts, whom Steve and I interviewed on Conservative Republican Forum for winning, and he will now face Barney Frank. So it's time to retire Barney, and I want to say wish Sean lots of luck, and I hope he'll come back, and maybe I'll even get him on Liberty Bell Hour also. And would also love to interview Christine and some of the other excellent candidates we've got running. So, you know, God bless these people. One thing, if I've learned one thing this year, it's how incredibly difficult it is to be a normal everyday person and run for office, and you're just a conservative anyway, to be a normal everyday conservative American, and to really put yourself out there and your personal life and your family on the line and take all of these hits day in and day out. I'm just amazed by what the strength, by what these people are able to put up with, their strength and their courage and their conviction. So I'm excited. We're taking it back in 2010. Okay, so I see that Steve is on the line here, so let me go ahead and bring him in, and we'll get his take on this, and then we'll talk about his upcoming election. Hey, Steve.
Hey, Daria. Thanks for having me on.
All right. We get to switch roles a little bit tonight. I'm excited. Instead of co-host, now Steve is you're my guest. Kind of fun.
Yeah, that's my pleasure.
So, well, thanks for joining me.
You were very sedate tonight. You know, you really don't have any fire in your belly tonight. I don't know what we're going to do with you.
I know. I'm sorry. I'm really wound up. I'm so excited about Tuesday night. What are your thoughts on, just in general, too, not just Delaware, but do you have some thoughts on some of the other elections also?
Well, I thought it was really interesting that Rick Blasio was really trounced by Palladino for the GOP nomination for governor in New York. Rick Blasio is a pretty well-known figure at this point, and I don't think anybody really saw that coming. I didn't see any coverage of that pre-Tuesday, so that was an interesting one. In terms of Sean Bielak, I wasn't really surprised that he won that particular primary. We had interviewed him. We had interviewed his opponent, Earl Schally. And I had actually had the opportunity to meet Sean in person when he was down here, I think back in March. And I was very impressed with him. I think, you know, he's got an uphill battle there, as many of our candidates do, going up against entrenched incumbents. But I think that he's got the wind at his back on that one. So that's an interesting one. In terms of the, in terms of Christine O'Donnell, it was impressive, her win. I don't think anybody saw, the amount, the margin that she ended up winning by. As far as Karl Rove, Karl Rove is and I saw him this morning actually talking about it on Fox News. He is a Fox News political analyst. And as he said, people expect him, the audience expects him to be a straight shooter and say what he thinks. And we don't have to agree with him. At the end of the day, he will support, the Republican nominee. And he is, with his 527 or whatever kind of group he has, he is raising money for Republican candidates. He does have some valid points about whether Christine O'Donnell will be able to be victorious in the general election. She seems like a very attractive, and I don't just mean in terms of her appearance, but her personality and her stand on many of the fiscal issues as a very attractive candidate. Unfortunately, she does have this trail of video behind her that people are going to use against her. She does have some interesting views, not considering people who have AIDS, victims of AIDS, and equating AIDS to, heart disease, which I think, again, will be used against her. But I think she was much younger when she made those statements, and I think that people are allowed to mature and change their points of view on things. Most of those interviews are 12, 13 years old. So, I do think that she can also point to the fact that she was not in political circles at that time. She was an activist. She has a very religious background, and that's fine. She's just going to have to be careful to make sure that people understand that these are her personally held beliefs, and that, hopefully she's libertarian, as Andy Levy said last night on Red Eye, as to how she's going to handle that as a legislator and not try to legislate all of her beliefs. I think that's where she could get herself into trouble. But as a Republican myself who had some misgivings about some of our primary candidates, now they're our nominee, and they're a heck of a lot better than the liberal or progressive Democrat that they're facing. So we have to all kind of unify and support the conservative, better candidates.
Right, exactly. So, well, speaking of good conservative candidates, how are things going with your campaign, and what are the issues that you feel? Let's start, because you're running for Florida State House, so let's kind of start at the state level. What are the top issues that you feel are most important for our state, and just kind of share with the audience what where you stand on them, and then we can kind of look at it from a national perspective also.
Well, I think the number one issue, obviously, is jobs in this state. But the number one issue that's going to confront our legislature starting 2011 is going to be our budget. And they are kind of linked. We have to get our budget under control. We're not going to have the so-called stimulus dollars that we had for the 2010 cycle. And if we don't close our budget gap, we're going to have a problem, and we really have no choice because we have a balanced budget law in Florida. So we have to start there, I think, with an audit of our budget, an audit of our agencies and departments to find fraud, waste, and duplication and get rid of them and see how much money we're able to save there. I think we also need to consider zero-based budgeting, which basically means that any department, any agency, rather than asking for some percentage increase on their budget from the previous year, starts at zero, and they have to justify everything that's in their budget. And that will help us to prevent the aforementioned fraud, waste, and duplication from creeping back in going forward. I think that's the best way to go about that. Now, I've also thought about and proposed, although I don't have specific figures, not being an economist, that we should probably lower our property taxes and offset that with an increase to our sales tax. I prefer to tax people on what they spend rather than on what they produce. And I also don't think that the property tax rules are really working for a lot of Floridians right now. I think that'll put more people back into, well, first off, it'll put people that are currently in their homes in a position to stay there. But I think it'll also help the housing market by lowering the cost for somebody who wants to get into the housing market. So also, by using a slightly higher sales tax, I think that broadens our tax base. It will include illegal immigrants, it will include tourists, and it will include renters. And it will take some of the tax burden away from our homeowners and spread it around a little bit. And then I think the other thing we need to do is we need to look at our corporate tax rates and the licensing fees and other regulations that make it hard for people to start and expand their businesses here in Florida.
Yeah, that's excellent. Kind of like, you know, when you were talking about the sales tax, it sort of reminds me of the fair tax, but at a state level.
Well, that's basically where the idea comes from. The other thing is, I think, and I know I'm probably one of the only people that's actually running on this year, is I think we need to drop our ban on drilling for oil and natural gas in Florida's waters. And I know right now that's not necessarily the politically correct thing to say, but I think if people actually analyze the reality of that, they'll see that it's really the thing to do. The Deepwater Horizon accident, while we don't have all the information yet, was probably caused by the fact that it was in 5,000 feet of water. And the inability to contain it more quickly was certainly impacted by the fact it was in 5,000 feet of water. And what people need to understand before they start saying we need to permanently ban offshore oil drilling in Florida's waters, as our governor tried to do, they need to understand that in 5,000 feet of water, in deep water, the oil is under tremendous pressure and it's superheated, and it increases the possibility of the kind of blowout that we had. And also, the blowout preventer is deep underwater, whereas in shallower water, it's much more accessible, so you can shut down any leaks much more quickly and contain any leaks much more quickly. And it's also much safer to pipe the oil directly from a rig a few miles off our shore. And let me be clear that I want it to be over the horizon, not where you can see it from our beaches. I don't want to hurt our tourist industry. But our state waters in the Gulf go out 10 miles. That's well over the horizon. But it's a lot safer to pipe it in from a rig than it is to use a tanker. Most of the accidents we've ever had with oil historically have been with tankers. In fact, until this year, where we had two accidents within 6 months, there were no accidents in the Gulf on oil rigs. And the second accident was contained very quickly, where there was no spill, and there was no loss of life, and it was in much shallower water than the Deepwater Horizon.
Yeah, well,
and we need those jobs, and we need that oil.
Yeah, exactly. And it's, you know, and it's the environmental lobby that ties all of this up, that totally, you know, puts the ban on drilling on our own shores in shallow water and on land in places like ANWR.
Absolutely.
And it's frustrating. So, now you mentioned illegal immigration a little bit ago when you were talking about raising the sales tax. So let's go ahead and, tackle that issue here in Florida. What are some of the ideas you have to curb that problem or to, end that problem, actually?
Well, I like Arizona's SB 1070, but Representative Snyder and Bill McCollum proposed a bill that went even a little bit further to address concerns that some people have about racial profiling. They proposed that everybody that gets stopped or is arrested will simply be checked to see if they're here, have their legal status checked, their immigration status checked. So if everybody's being checked, you can't accuse anybody of racial profiling with that. Not that I think that the law from Arizona had that problem. It specifically said that you can't use race as an issue or a way of deciding whether or not to check for immigration status. And I think that proposal that Representative Snyder came up with would be one that I would probably co-sponsor and certainly support. We really have to address this issue at the state level because it's obvious that the federal government is going to shirk that responsibility. They have and they continue to. And it does cost our state, according to the Federation of American Immigration Reform, approximately $3.8 billion annually just to the state of Florida for the costs of K-12 education, medical care, and incarceration of illegal aliens who committed other crimes here. And that's an unsustainable burden on us. And even if, you know, many people say, well, you know, the taxes, the sales taxes that we collect from illegal immigrants that work here offset that fiscal cost. And according to the same research study, we still would lay out $2.3 billion a year in Florida, even with those offsets. And what you have to also consider is if those people weren't here working illegally, then we would have people that were here on legal work visas. They would be getting paid a fair wage, and they would be paying even more in sales taxes because they'd have more money to spend. So it's right. Not a good argument. And the bottom line is, if somebody breaks in your house, then you don't take them in, clothe them, feed them, and take care of the medical expenses. You call the police. And these folks are here illegally, and they have broken into our country. Now, obviously, some of them are here for a better life. And those people, I would like, you know, not that I do not support a pathway to citizenship. I think that we need to have them here legally because they're being exploited too. It's not fair to them. But they've jumped the line. And the people that want to come here legally, want to go through the process legally, whether it's for citizenship or work visas, they have to be the ones that get priority, not the people that came here illegally. And no nation can be sovereign and no nation can be safe if they don't enforce their immigration laws. And there are people that are coming here that are not just looking for a better life. They are running drugs. They are smuggling weapons. They are trafficking humans. And some of them are terrorists. And right. We can't ignore that in the post-9/11 world, no matter what some of the progressives and some of the groups like La Raza say.
Well, exactly, and it's astonishing. I mean, we just commemorated the 9th anniversary of 9/11, and we still don't have control of our borders. And it's just so frustrating that we can't separate the two issues, or we can separate them, but the politicians refuse to. I mean, in my opinion, securing the borders is one thing, a solitary thing, all by itself. Outside of any type of streamlining of our current immigration system. Let me just get your thoughts on that. And also, you know, do you support programs like E-Verify where employers would actually incur fines for knowingly hiring illegals?
Well, I definitely support E-Verify. Now, I understand that there are some bugs in the system and there is some problems with it that make it somewhat cumbersome for small business owners to use. With that said, also it's supposedly a little inaccurate, but even with that said, I think it should be used. I think that there should be a program where they get feedback from the business owners that use it so that they can make it better. And as long as somebody's using the system and they've tried to verify, if they hire somebody that the system tells them is okay and later on ICE shows up and they find out the person wasn't here legally, that's not the business owner's fault. And they shouldn't be held responsible for that. I do also just want to point out, it's not just our borders. Florida has more coastline than any state in the contiguous United States. And from our own interviews with Michael Cutler, the former INS agent, we know that there are people coming into this country by coming by ship. They're stowing away on ships, and they sneak off the ships when they get into harbor, and they come into the country that way. So it's not just a matter of securing our borders, and it's also a matter of internal enforcement. Some people overstay their visas. Some people commit visa fraud. Every one of the 19 hijackers that participated in the 9/11 attacks committed visa fraud. They weren't here to be educated. They were here to learn how to fly planes in the buildings and to carry out that attack. So, you know, that's the other thing. We don't have enough agents out there doing the job to protect us, and it's not their fault, it's the government's fault. We need to fix that. And the states are going to have to try to do their part to help. And it is not unconstitutional. It is not preempting federal law. It is in concert with federal law, and in fact, it's weaker than federal law. Both SB 1070 and the law proposed by Representative Snyder are weaker. The federal law requires you, does not require you to have any prior reason to stop somebody, to ask them for their immigration status, to ask them for their green card. And both of the state laws do. So it's definitely not preemptive. It's definitely not going to be found unconstitutional when it winds its way to the Supreme Court. You there? Daria? Daria? Can you hear me? Daria? Can you hear me?
Yes, are you there? Are you here?
Yeah.
I'm so sorry. I don't know if it was my computer or Blog Talk Radio, but all of a sudden the switchboard said waiting for host to call in. Somehow I got disconnected here.
Live radio.
Oh, yeah. What can you do? Okay. I apologize for that. So, so maybe you could just, I'm not sure where we left off, but why don't you just maybe go back to the beginning of your answer and we'll go from there. I know the last thing I heard you say was about the 9/11 terrorists that overstayed their visas.
Well, actually they committed visa fraud. They misrepresented why they were coming here. And what I basically said is we have people that are overstaying visas, that are committing visa fraud, that are stowing away on ships, that are, you know, not here necessarily for a better life, but whether they're here for a better life or to commit crimes, whatever that crime might be, we don't have enough federal agents out there to do the job, and we're going to have to use state and county and local resources to help them. These are the men and women that are on the streets. They're our eyes and ears, and I believe that, you know, when they make a stop, when they arrest somebody, they should, just as a routine, just find out what immigration status is for whoever it is. I mean, you need to be a citizen to have a driver's license in Florida. So as soon as you show your valid driver's license, you know, that ends it. If you don't have your driver's license, they'll have to check a little more. Now, I've heard that, you know, some sheriffs and some law enforcement police chiefs don't want to do this. Well, with all due respect to them, their job is not to decide which laws they will and will not enforce and which laws are going to be on the books. Their oath is to uphold the laws of Florida and the laws of the United States. So, you know, the legislature and the people will decide what laws we have, and then law enforcement will have the job of enforcing them. And if they don't like that, then I think there's plenty of people that want those jobs and will hire other people to do it.
Yeah, amen. Exactly, because we've got to get a handle on this problem. Absolutely, you know, I couldn't agree with you more. And speaking of, you know, how we were tying this in with, you know, with national security, also, you know, I know Tom Trento of the Florida Security Council has been our guest a few times on our Conservative Republican Forum program. Are there any issues unique to Florida as pertains to terrorism that you'd like to see addressed, or, you know, what are some of your thoughts on that, aside from the immigration aspect of it?
Well, I'm not sure how much the state government can do about that. I know Tom Trento does a lot of investigative work on mosques to see if they're being used as recruiting centers for terrorists, and to see if some of the imams and organizers of the mosques are using them to fundraise for organizations like Hamas and Hezbollah. But you know, that's kind of a law enforcement slash national security issue. But until it's so tricky in our country, we do have freedom of religion and freedom of assembly, and we have to be very careful about monitoring religious institutions to see about these things. And I think it comes down to private organizations like Florida Security Council to kind of find the probable cause so that the FBI can get in there and do that. But I'm not sure how much the state government can do with that. They can be partners with the federal government on that, but I don't think they can be the lead organization with that.
Right. And I know, there was a lot. I went to a city council meeting in Pompano several months ago to raise questions about that huge mosque that they're building in Pompano Beach. And it's very scary because, that particular mosque is being built in sort of an area where, they could recruit a lot of at-risk, young adults, young men into the jihadist lifestyle. And I know that there are people really looking into that. And so it's just, I'm glad that we do have private organizations because I hear what you're saying and we have to be careful. But it just seems to me that, you could walk into most churches that I know of, and I don't think it's the same with a lot of these mosques. Pretty much any Catholic church during normal, business hours would be open, and anybody could walk in there and say a prayer, or even if they're not Catholic, anybody could go in and see what was going on. And it's just doesn't seem to be the same there. So it is something that we definitely need to keep an eye on. And it's also, I think it's also an issue for that calls for, some citizen activism too, such as what we've been seeing, in the course of the last 19 months.
So we have to be careful because there are instances in history, including American history, where whole groups have been kind of lumped together and scapegoated, and we don't want to find ourselves in that position. And it's a difficult, I hate to even use the phrase, slippery slope. Jews were scapegoated in Nazi Germany because of the economic problems there, and Hitler used Jews and gypsies and other groups and scapegoated them, and we don't want that. And in the United States, once we got into World War II, we interned the Japanese, we interned Italian Americans, we interned German Americans, and unfortunately that was wrong, but it was done because of a reaction, a fearful reaction. And we have to try to find that balance, not to scapegoat an entire group of people based on our fear, and yet we have to protect our security.
Right, because we've gone a little too far to the other extreme, I think. So, yeah, I agree with you. We need to come back on balance. So let's talk about another issue that's also critically important at the state level, and that is education. How do you feel about school vouchers and school choice, and what's your position on public education?
Well, I am for school vouchers and school choice. I am very much against tenure, and while I would like to see some sort of a system that would allow for merit pay for teachers, I do think that the bill that came out of the state legislature, and I'm a Republican, and that's a Republican state legislature, but it was a flawed bill. And while I find very few things that I agree with Charlie Crist on, I have to say I agree with him on vetoing that particular bill. I wouldn't have voted for it as it stood, because what was missing from it was a way to truly measure the progress that a student and the teachers teaching those students were making. There was no baseline. There was no test at the beginning of the year that tested the math skills, the history knowledge, the scientific knowledge of a child at the beginning of the year, and with a corresponding test at the end of the year to give you a measurement. And the FCAT, I think, has been relied on far too much. Standardized tests have a lot of problems. I can tell you that when I was in school, I was certainly not an A student, but I was always in the 99th percentile on almost every standardized test I ever took. Some people take these tests and do really well, and some people just don't test well. So if you're going to do it, I think you truly do have to have some sort of a baseline to start with. But I don't like tenure for teachers. I want teachers to be paid well based on their merit. Tenure, to me, makes no sense. It takes all the incentive out of a job to do a good job if you don't think you can be fired. And how many jobs do you know of where you can, just after X number of years, get tenure and feel secure whether or not you're actually doing a good job in the private sector? Not too many.
No.
So I think that that unions, unfortunately, while they have had their place in history in the United States, I think have really done more to harm workers than they are doing to help them in the long run. And our public employee unions really are not doing any help to their employees or to the state right now. And it's the leadership. It's not the rank and file, you know, for the most part. They're out there doing their jobs, and you've got these leaders that are asking for, in my opinion, unsustainable pensions, unsustainable salaries, and you know, we need people in Tallahassee that are willing to say not just no, but hell no, we can't do this.
Yeah.
I know in talking to the various PACs for the police and for the firefighters, I tried to be very honest with them that those of them that have been on the job for 20 years, their pensions we're going to have to pay. We've made promises to them, but for the people that are coming onto the job today, we've got to have a second tier, and we've got to pay them less, and we've got to have a different pension and benefit level for them. And frankly, I think that the police and firefighters that are on the job today have got to be willing to take a pay freeze for the time being. With so many people losing their jobs and taking pay cuts to keep their jobs or being underemployed in the private sector, I don't think it's unreasonable to ask public employees to take a pay freeze at this particular time until things get better. We're not asking them to take pay cuts at this point, but just a pay freeze to help us balance our budget. And the unions are saying no, and we've said it. We've seen it in New Jersey with Chris Christie, and he's standing up to them, and he's taking a lot of heat for it. And the unions continue to say no. But he's really standing his ground. We've seen it in Virginia, and I think Florida's going to need to have that sort of an attitude too.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. I mean, I'm just blown away in the best sense of that expression when I see what he's doing for New Jersey on behalf of the people, and it's just so refreshing to see somebody stand up and be a leader and do things that are right, that may not necessarily be popular, but are the right thing for the state. Steve, moving into, let's just, because we're kind of starting to wind down a little bit, coming to the last part of the show, I want to move into healthcare and, first of all, talk about Obamacare and, what your position is on that, and then, which I think I know, and then talk about maybe what you would propose in the state house in terms of, trying to help bring down the cost of health insurance.
Well, I think Obamacare is, by and large, it is unconstitutional to begin with. The individual mandate, you can't make people buy things. That's not what the Commerce Clause says. The Commerce Clause says that Congress can regulate interstate commerce. And right now, by definition, insurance, health insurance, is not interstate commerce because you can't buy insurance across state lines. It's actually one of the problems. So to say that you're going to mandate that people buy insurance, and if they don't, you're going to penalize them, I think is on its face unconstitutional. Also, we've already seen that it's going to raise the cost of health insurance. It's already raising it for people that have health insurance. It's going to increase the Medicaid rolls tremendously. I think from that, I heard 50 million right now, about 80 million by 2014, I think. I may be wrong about the date. And that's just going to put an even bigger burden on states because Medicaid is a state and federal partnership. That's also not sustainable. And part of the reason that insurance costs have already gone up is that, Obama likes to say that all these preventive care things like colonoscopies and such are going to be free. Well, they're not free. What they are is they're prepaid. They're front-loading the cost into your insurance plan, and then they can't charge you a copay for it. but you're still paying for it. There is no free lunch here.
Right.
So, you know, in terms of what the states can do, I think that, well, first off, it is a state issue. What we need to do is we need to enact meaningful tort reform in the states where they've done it, like Texas. They've lowered insurance costs and health care costs like 27%. They've also increased the number of specialists because doctors are more willing to come there to work when they know that they're not going to have ridiculous lawsuits against them. We can create state exchanges, state insurance exchanges, and we can have the states work with each other to allow for interstate commerce on that. We can have the ability to have somebody in Florida buy a cheaper insurance plan from, say, Texas, if the states work together on that. But otherwise, Obamacare is going to make things much worse than it ever was. And the other thing we can do is we can eliminate the mandates on insurance companies to provide certain types of coverage. Let people buy coverage based on their age and their risk factors that they want. There's no reason that a 29-year-old woman needs to be covered for a prostate exam. And there's also no reason for a man to be covered for a pap smear. You know, and these mandates that, you know, they say they're spreading the risk, but that's ridiculous. There is no risk factor there for those types of things. So if you eliminate those kind of mandates, you're going to lower the cost of insurance for everybody. And then we have safety nets in place for the people that don't have insurance or can't afford insurance. We have Medicaid. We have laws that require emergency rooms to treat anybody regardless of their ability to pay. Nobody goes without health care in this country if they seek it. Can it be better? Sure. And we'll find ways to make it better. But there's so much fraud and waste in Medicare and Medicaid, and they always talk about getting rid of it, but they never actually go about doing it. And if they actually did that, we might be able to sustain it. But the bottom line is government is not efficient. And to ask a government that can't run the post office properly, even to go break even, much less make any kind of a profit, to have them running healthcare is insane. And all we've done is just create a bunch of more bureaucracy without actually improving healthcare.
So true. Steve, listen, we have a caller on the line here, so I'm going to go ahead and bring him on. And Chris, I apologize. I didn't have my – I had a different computer screen up and didn't see you there holding. So let me go ahead and bring you on board. Good evening, Chris.
Good evening, Daria. Good evening, Steve.
How are you, sir?
Hello?
Go ahead and let us know your question.
I was listening to what you had to say about healthcare and about the sort of pay settlements for union types. There's something similar over here going on during the Trade Union Congress here. The least part of the members who are with the union said that they would back a sort of general strike in protest against all the pay cuts that have to go ahead in order to reduce and zero balance our deficit. And on the healthcare, over here we've already got a national healthcare service, and it really it's so inefficient that you've got the bureaucrats who tell the doctors and the patients when they can and can't meet. And you're talking about at the moment it's a 13.5% tax, straight from your pay packet in order to pay for it all. I'm looking at the numbers and thinking that you could be looking at like a 25% national insurance contribution for the whole of the nation to pay for it. And considering the sort of level of illegal immigration, it's going to be a system that's going to be so stretched that you're going to end up with a system where you're sort of rationed 7 minutes at the appointment. I was just wondering what your thoughts on
Daria, I don't know.
Chris, it's a really tough connection, but here's what I think I heard, and just let me know in the chat room. Chris, I think lives in England, And I believe you were stating that the government taxes you 13.5% out of your paycheck for nationalized medicine. And we were having it was really unclear. It was really fuzzy trying to hear you. So I'm not sure if you had a question or that was just a comment about the nationalized medical system in England. Can you let me know in the chat? Are you in the chat room, Chris? Because maybe we can might be easier if you had a question, type it in there, because it's really I can't really hear you that well. Very,
yeah.
A lot of interference on the line.
Mm-hmm.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. Can you hear me?
It's really hard, but so your comment was about the nationalized healthcare system in England, and was that correct? Did you say they take 13.5% out of your paycheck?
Yes, they call it national insurance contribution, but it's a mandated national insurance contribution. It's not a voluntary thing.
Right, so it's not, yeah, it's mandated by the government. And so what has that led to, in your opinion? I mean, what's it like over there?
Well, it really is quite bad over here because the bureaucrats set your appointment time with specialists. The amount of pressure there is on sort of just general practitioners, you know, your sort of family doctors, such that they're rationed about 7 minutes of appointment time. So you have to get everything out and diagnosed within 7 minutes, which is seriously impossible. And you could set up, you know, so if you report that you're sick on one thing, they'll bounce you all over the place in order to find stuff out. And they end up in sort of saying to you, look, get yourself signed off onto sickness benefits until we can sort it all out. So you're left on sickness benefits. And the power of the state here is such that the doctor says that you're not fit to work. No employer is allowed to have you on their premises working while you're on the sick line.
Wow.
And also, under New Labour, under Tony Blair and Brown, they were encouraging the employment, you know, they were encouraging the police agencies to kind of allow people to drift onto the sick so that unemployment figures would be kept, so they could report, you know, hey, employment's dropping, but more and more people were economically inactive and sort of left on the sick.
Well, okay. I'm not sure I caught that last part, but thanks for calling in. It was really hot. Really, we have a really bad connection, but the one part I did get, Steve, from that is, thank you for your call, Chris, is that this is sort of a nightmare scenario of what awaits us if we go through with, if Obamacare is not repealed. The one thing I did hear from Chris's comments were how they were limiting doctors to 7 minutes per patient. So 7 minutes to, I guess, examine someone and make a diagnosis. So that's what we have to look forward to, America.
Well, yeah, their national healthcare system is, I believe, the third largest employer on the planet, and most of it is not medical care, it's administrators. And it's so large that they can't repeal it because it's also one of their largest voting blocks. But their rate of death for things that we take for granted that people pretty much don't die of here in America, like, well, prostate cancer is a great example. Their rate is much higher, their death rate, than the United States, because people have to wait so long just for the test, so it doesn't get caught early, and therefore it's much more difficult to treat successfully. You know, people die of things that they shouldn't die of, and if our goal here in this country is to provide better health care rather than more health care, the British model is certainly not one we want to follow.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm sorry for, you know, letting that call go on, but I was able to hear some of it, and I just wanted to pull as much as I could out of that because I wanted, you know, want people to know that this is what awaits us if we don't stop this train. So, Steve, in the remaining minutes, though, let everyone know your website and if you need any help on your campaign, how they can donate, things like that.
Well, the website is www.electrosenblum.com. That's elect, R-O-S-E-N-B-L-U-M.com. Certainly, you can always use financial contributions, which can be done over the website via PayPal, or there's also an address to mail a check if you want. And you don't have to live in the district or even in Florida to contribute to the campaign. I accept contributions from all states, even the state of confusion. But if you live in the area and you want to help out making phone calls or in any other way, there's also contact information on the website for that. And I hope people will go there to learn more about where I stand on the issues, more about me, and to help out.
Hey, and Steve, one other thing I should have asked you this earlier. Just let people know, what are the parameters of your district, just in case we do have some local people listening in that might want to help you out?
District 89 goes from the southern part of the city of West Palm Beach down through into the northern part of Boynton Beach, a little bit of Green Acres. It's one of these heavily gerrymandered districts. There's actually a link on the website on the right side that lets you pull up a map of the district, and there's also a link where you can put your address in, and it'll tell you if you're in the district or not. Or, of course, you can always just pull out your voter registration card, and it'll tell you if you're in District 89 or not.
Excellent. Okay, and I want to also point out that Steve is also a contributor to parkbench.com, and you can read his excellent commentary there. That's parkbench.com. And, again, we co-host Conservative Republican Forum here on Blog Talk Radio, 6 p.m. Eastern every Saturday evening. And we're also rebroadcast both Conservative Republican Forum and the Liberty Bell Hour on redstatetalkradio.com. And I want to encourage everyone to please go over there and check it out, because there's an excellent lineup of hosts, including Diane Student of Freedom's Wings and Primo Mondoni of Red State Town Hall. And we also have a new program that Steve and I participate in on Monday nights with Red State Talk Radio called Red State Roundtable. And I'm really loving that format. We have three panelists. We take turns every week. Primo asks us about, you know, three or four different issues, and we really have a lively, spirited discussion. So I would encourage you to check that out as well Monday evenings on Blog Talk Radio. Well, Steve, thank you so much for being my guest tonight. Good luck with the campaign, and we're all pulling for you, and I hope to bring you back as the victor after November 2nd, and we can have a celebratory interview.
Well, thank you, Daria. It's a pleasure being here. You, as always, do a really great show.
Thank you. All right, everyone. Have a great week. Keep the faith. The Tea Party is winning, and we're taking our country back. Talk to you next week.
Delicate melody, but I say I like the bruises, 'cause a melody don't mean a thing if we don't have the strength to sing. And I won't be made to ever feel ashamed. changing. As if all the founding fathers seem to get it wrong. But I say, I still believe in the greatest liberator, innovator, cultivator. You changed already. You went and lost your pride. But I'm American made. I got American parts. I got American faith in American heart. And go on, raise the flag. I got stars. Got American faith in America's heart. Go on.